We call the joint meeting, the House and Senate Judiciary Committees together. Today's January 23rd, and the time is 1:35. We have with the from the House side, Representative Max Bloomberg, Representative Lance Pruitt, Representative Richard Foster. Richard, thank you. Representative Ledoux and Representative Millett. I'm sorry, Sharice. Okay, anyway, so what we're going to do here is I'm just, that's the House members, and I'm going to, Senator Coghill is the chair of the Senate. I'm going to give him the gavel, and he can call the Senate roll and lead the meeting.
All right, thank you, Representative Geller. And so today present with us, we have Senator Olson, myself, Senator Coghill. We have one of the long-standing friends of mine. What's his name? Senator Dyson. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski is just now coming in, so.
No, I'm going over there. I got to go.
Senator Wilkowski, we're going to crowd in over here.
Yeah, I don't want to spill coffee all over there.
Can I say Representative?
John, Representative Lynn, step right up.
How about it? John, that was a magnificent speech you made yesterday.
Thank you.
It was just magnificent.
Today, what we have before us is an overview that we'll be looking at with the court system, the public defender, and the Office of Public Advocacy. And appreciate the two meetings that we'll get together with the House Senate Committee. Look forward to it. Familiar digs to me, so I appreciate that. If we could have the court system come on up and introduce not only yourself, but if you have any of those with you. We'll begin the discussion. And I guess the question to you is, would you like questions along the way? How would you like to proceed on that?
Whatever's easiest, as they occur to you, I'll be able to answer them.
Put yourself on the record, and the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Just a little further up.
My name is Nancy Mead, and I am General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Part of my job is to work with the legislature on any bills that may impact the court system, and this is my second session in that role. Last year was my first, and I do now what was done for many years by Doug Wooliver, whom all of you probably know, well, do know, I'm sure. And he was promoted to Deputy Director last year, and he is still here in Juneau working on the court's budget, and I handle the bills, which is the work that he did formerly do. And in that role, I appeared before this committee, both committees, several times last year, and expect that I will again this year. I'd like to begin my overview of the court system by describing how our branch fits within the overall state government and how it compares to the legislative and executive branches. Like the legislative branch, the judicial branch is small when compared to the executive branch and state government as a whole. Budget-wise, the court system represents about 1.5%, 1.4% of the state's operating budget. We have about 800 employees, and this compares with about 15,000 who are employed by the state of Alaska. And those 800 employees work in 43 different court locations. Despite our small size, though, the court system has probably more private citizens that walk through its doors every day than any agency or department of the executive branch. And for that reason, a lot of Alaskans, especially those in smaller communities, see the courts and the courthouses as the face of Alaskan government. Even though we're small, we're still an entire branch, which means that we, like the legislature, have to handle many administrative matters internally. With our own staff. So we have our own departments of human resources, information technology, facilities, and fiscal operations, for example. We do our own procurements, lease arrangements, accounting, and other administrative matters like that. The Alaska court system is different from court systems from most other states in three main ways. First, we have what's called a unified judiciary, meaning that all the courts are administered centrally by one administrative office, which is headquartered in Anchorage. There are no county or municipal courts here, and this is unusual among courts in the country. Second, our court system's funding comes entirely from the legislature. Unlike courts in other states or other places, our receipts do not help us. They go straight into the general fund, like all the other executive branch or most other executive branch agencies and departments. And third, the day-to-day operations of the court system are run not by a judge, as with lots of other state courts, but by an administrative director, that is currently Christine Johnson, who's hired by the Supreme Court. The Constitution sets out this organizational structure, as well as the powers and duties of the judiciary and the different levels of the court. And although we are a unified court system, the Constitution also states that that judicial districts must be established, and we therefore have four districts for purposes of administration, each with one presiding judge who is appointed by the Chief Justice for a two-year term. You should have in front of you a handout, which is a map, an outline map of the state of Alaska. I think it was emailed to all of you if you don't have it. I have a few extras. It looks like this. This map shows the district lines, and you can see that the first judicial district is mainly southeast. The second is the North Slope, including Barrow, Kotzebue, and Nome. The third is South Central, that has our biggest and busiest state courts, Anchorage, Palmer, and Kenai, as well as others. And the fourth is the interior, kind of swathing southwest, including Fairbanks and the Bethel regions. I'll get back to the map in a few moments to point out some court locations, but first I'd like to explain how the courts themselves are organized and what each does. We have four levels of court. The Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals are our two appellate courts, which review decisions of the trial courts, and the superior and district courts are our trial courts, which initially hear and decide cases. The jurisdiction and responsibilities of these courts, all courts, are set out not only in the Judiciary Article of the Constitution, but also Title 22 of the Alaska Statutes. The Supreme Court has five justices, and it hears all the cases that are appealed to it. In FY12, to give you an example of the numbers, 427 cases were filed in the Supreme Court. It hears oral argument about once a month in Anchorage, where it's headquartered, and also travels to Juneau and Fairbanks about quarterly to hear oral argument on cases in those locations. In the last few years, beginning in early 2010, the Supreme Court also started a program through which they hear oral argument at different high schools around the state. It's an outreach and education program. They've held oral argument with true cases and attorneys arguing in the auditorium at West High School in Anchorage, Juneau Douglas High School, Lathrop, Mount Edgecombe in Sitka, and a few others. That's been a very popular and well-received and well-reviewed program and does seem to help with educating people about what the court does and the sorts of things that they take up. In accordance with the Constitution, the five Supreme Court justices select one of their members to be the Chief Justice. That person holds the office for 3 years, during which he or she is the administrative head of the court system. You're probably already aware that Justice Carpinetti, the former Chief Justice until his term was up this past summer, has announced his retirement effective at the end of this month, very soon, and he'll be missed terribly by everyone who works with him and knows him. His seat will be reappointed by the governor. Actually, it's due on Friday, January 25th. The governor is currently deciding between four names that were given to him for a new justice to take that seat. The other appellate court is called the Court of Appeals. It hears exclusively appeals from criminal and quasi-criminal matters. By quasi-criminal, I mean juvenile cases, which are not considered criminal but have a criminal aspect to them, and cases like that are related to criminal in some way. It has three judges, Judge Mannheimer, Judge Bolger, and Judge Allard. Judge Allard was just appointed within the last couple of months. As for trial courts, the Superior Court is the trial court of general jurisdiction, meaning it has original jurisdiction over both civil and criminal matters. There are 42 judges in 13 locations, and you can see on your maps that I referred to a moment ago where the Superior Court locations are. They are the starred and circle locations, and you're probably fairly familiar with those locations. Superior Court judges also sometimes travel to other locations within their district on a temporary basis to cover case needs as they arise. Nearly all of the 42 Superior Court judges handle all case types that come in the courthouse doors. The one exception, notably, is in Anchorage, our busiest court, where for efficiency reasons, the The Superior Court judges have split themselves administratively, so five judges handle only criminal cases. Those would be felonies, since it's Superior Court. And the other 12 Anchorage Superior Court judges handle only the civil matters. But that is just an administrative fix that they've done to best address the caseload there most efficiently. The other trial court is the district court. It's a court of limited jurisdiction. It has 23 judges, and they can hear certain types of cases as provided in statute. They cover 30 communities, and you can see from the map what those communities are. In order to give a more helpful picture of the work of these courts, I've handed out a colored one-page pie chart that I'd like to review just for a moment. This is a summary of the FY11 filings statewide. Does anybody need a copy?
Good. I think we're good.
Are you okay? Okay. What this page shows are straight numbers from our statistics database. You'll notice the top graph is a combination of the bottom two. On the bottom, the left is the Superior Court filings, and the right is the District Court filings. So I'd like to point out a few things that we get from these statistics. The first, if you look at the top chart, which is Superior and District Court filings combined, is the biggest single case type we have, the largest slice of the pie, and that carries over into the District Court, are minor offense cases. Minor offenses are not cases involving minors. They are generally violations or infractions or things that are non-jailable offenses. These people are not filling our jails. The people who come in with minor offenses are mostly traffic tickets. That's how I think of them. There's some other tickets as well, but things that can be charged on a citation. But the number you can see is very high, 80,000 of them in FY11. So each of those cases individually takes far less time than many other cases, but the volume and the fact that the number is constantly growing makes the efficient processing of these cases very important to us. They're not something that a lot of people notice, but to us, they're such a big slice of the pie that we do spend time trying to become more efficient with those. And in fact, in cooperation with the Department of Public Safety and local law enforcement agencies around the state, we've begun an electronic system of filing and processing these citations, so they're transmitted directly from the officer's handheld machine where he or she writes a ticket to the court, and that is spreading and being implemented statewide and has been really a boon for all the agencies who formerly had to enter data individually. Below the combined pie chart is the two trial courts are split out according to their jurisdictions.
Senator Dyson?
Before you leave, sir. I'll wait. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll watch for you.
Thanks. So on the bottom left, if you look at the Superior Court, some of you might be surprised to see the size of the pie slices and to see that our Superior Court really does much more than just felony cases, which receives most of the attention. And so it's not exact, but you can almost say that there are about a quarter felonies, a quarter domestic relations, and those include child custody determinations, dissolutions, divorces, paternity determinations, and about a quarter probate. Probate is not just wills and trusts and estate issues that people do assume goes with that name, but it's also protective proceedings, guardianships and conservatorships, which are growing, and mental health commitments and other commitments. So that's all the protective proceedings. The smallest slice of the Superior Court pie is the regular civil cases. And you'll see also there's civil cases handled by both the district and Superior Court. The difference is the amount in controversy. The statutory cutoff is $100,000. So if the case has higher than $100,000 in controversy, it's in Superior Court, which generally handles the more complex cases. But moving over to the district court for a moment.
My question now.
Okay, Fred, you're up.
Thank you.
Then I'll have.
Looking at Superior Court criminal stuff, I've certainly heard that many of the minor felonies get pled out before they get to court. I'm impressed with the numbers in each one of these pie charts, but it's been represented to me that perhaps the justice process is being subverted by prosecutors stacking charges and, you know, in a bargaining position with the defense. which hurries up the process and so on, but perhaps doesn't allow judges to, perhaps to weigh the evidence and use more of their wisdom. Some have represented to me that maybe over 80% of the cases get pled out in criminal court. Not everybody that talks to me tells me the complete truth, except you. What's your sense of that?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I will try to give the complete truth. My understanding from our statistics is over 90%, 95% perhaps, of the criminal cases do get pled out. That is, the parties agree to a sentence or a punishment or what should happen with the case and then present it to the court with an agreement, what's called a Rule 11 agreement, a plea agreement, and the defendant changes his or her plea to guilty and has agreed to take the consequences of whatever the has been offered and bargained for. I would not characterize that as a subversion of the system in that it has worked that way for a very long time. It is necessary to keep the system working in some ways, and whether the district attorneys or prosecutors charge improperly to get a better bargaining position is not something that I could address or speak to. The judges have not, I've not heard that through any official channel or anything like that. I think that the theory behind getting guilty pleas and Rule 11 agreements is that the prosecutors know their case and know if, for example, some facts are not as they thought when they first brought the charges, or if witnesses are not what they were thinking when they first brought the charges. So it's very complex. The Department of Law and others could much better address why plea agreements are entered. When they are entered, those agreements are brought before a judge to assess whether to accept the agreement. Now, the judge at that point, of course, hasn't been in trial and doesn't know the facts of the case near as well as the attorneys involved. And when both parties are represented by an attorney, the judge is likely to defer to a great extent to their knowledge of the case and why they think that a plea should be entered. There is a colloquy that takes place on the record between the judge and the attorneys to make sure that the defendant entered the agreement with open eyes, knowingly, intelligently, and is waiving whatever his or her rights might otherwise be to go to trial.
Senator Dyson, just for what it's worth, we will have both those who prosecute and those who defend come to that question as well, at least on the Senate side. So I intend to have that question kind of along the way.
Yeah. And
follow up on that? Follow up.
Many of the folks who are guilty of relatively minor crimes do now they have the money to hire good defense. So then the public defender, you know, is there. And my experience with those guys is they're overloaded. And it would certainly, I think, be possible that these folks, a public defender, are much more likely to cop a plea and get out. And I never meant to intend that charges were stacked that weren't valid charges. But indeed, there's lots of minor things, you know, that can be put on it that could affect the bargaining process.
Right. Through the chair, just a quick response to that, and the public defender is speaking immediately after me, and I know the Department of Law is coming as well, but that agency enjoys a fantastic reputation nationwide and here in the state for having lawyers who are doing the right things for their clients. I don't know their staffing, whether they, I know they're a very busy office, but it's never been implied to me that they would improperly plea to have their client plea to something that they didn't think was appropriate. But again, they'll address that, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Probably many iterations of that. I think Representative Gruenberg had a point, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mead, I was always under the impression that family law cases, as they're called domestic relations cases, occupied far more than 25% of the filing. I was thinking that the percentage was around 40%. Am I wrong, or has it changed?
I'm able to speak to about the last 5 years' worth of statistics that I've reviewed, and it has been fairly steady in those 5 years at about 25%. So I've not seen the number 40, but that may be in a time period that I have not recently looked at.
And does that include domestic violence cases, or is that all under the district court?
The petitions for domestic violence protective orders are civil actions that are handled in the district court. You can see that's the teal blue piece at the top of the pie. So this it does not include petitions for domestic violence protective orders.
If I may follow up.
Yes, sir.
From my experience in practice in Anchorage, the family law cases for interim motions and some trials are handled by masters, standing masters. Children's cases generally handled by at least one standing master. Probate, standing master. Some of the felonies, interim bail hearings, pleas, and stuff like that go before district court judges, this sort of thing. Civil cases, generally, unless a special master is appointed, are handled solely by the judge. And I'm wondering, because we seem to be appointing more judges these days, whether we could see if some of the civil matters could be handled by masters, because it seems to me, my recollection is a lot of the judges are assigned to the civil division, yet only 11% of the cases go there. And if we were able to redistribute the workload so that discovery motions and things like that in the civil division could go before some masters, discovery masters, things like that, we might be able, number one, to save the cost, number two, to have some judges on these other areas where important decisions, interim custody and stuff like that, if necessary, could be handled by judges and rather than by standing masters or whatever. I'm just wondering if 11% of the, what percentage of the judges are in the civil division statewide, handling 11% of the cases?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the only place where the judges are split between civil and criminal judges is in Anchorage. It's our busiest court, so I'll talk about that. But in all the other places, Fairbanks, for example, the Superior Court judges have both active criminal and civil cases on their docket all the time. In Anchorage, we have 5 criminal judges and 12 civil judges, but perhaps I was misleading when I said that previously. Those 5 civil judges don't handle just the what's called civil on this chart. They handle domestic relations, they handle the children's cases, the children in need of aid, and they handle the probate cases. So those 12 handle all non-criminal matters. Does that address your question? Let me also just add, I'm sorry, that the Chief Justice currently is involved in a study of our magistrate judges and masters and how best and most efficiently to use those. And there's a committee that's working on whether there could be improvements to either delegate more things to masters in different areas or to move master jurisdiction and duties among different areas to make things work better. So that's something that we, the presiding judges and the Chief Justice, are looking at.
Just keep it brief. And the reason I'm only as a time management issue, I've got 2 other people behind you. I want to make sure that you are able to round out your presentation.
Thank you.
Representative Gruber.
We should talk privately about this. I'd like to see the results of that survey and the study and see what is being done in both from the point of view of these the judiciary committees and also the court's budget subcommittee, which I sit on.
Yeah.
I would like to be sure this is done as efficiently as possible.
And probably one of the things, Representative Gruenberg, that maybe even in your judiciary committee you might want to do, because I'm going to be asking about it, and that is the time management issue, because when we get into child need of aid issues, we have real tight timelines. When you have preemption, you have real tight timelines. And how the different districts manage that. It's something that I'm interested in, so that we have a context on, if we're making a law, how does it affect that kind of management scheme? So anyway. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of more things just on this pie chart page. The district court, which has 23 judges, is also supplemented with 44 magistrates. These are people who are not judges, not constitutional judges, but are hired and fired as regular employees of the court system. They handle many of those minor offenses that you see on there, and domestic violence, protective orders, and small claims actions. So those 44 magistrates, you know, we couldn't operate without them. They aid our efficiency very much in handling those sorts of cases. So I could provide more details about caseload and trends, but for now, let me just mention three trends that we do see. Our cases have been steadily, slightly growing over the past 5 years or so, at a rate of about 5% per year. The fastest growing case type is probate. It's that dark blue piece of the pie, and our statistics don't give any details on why case numbers might change, but we have heard that the increasing aging population might have something to do with it, and a lot of protective proceedings are being filed more than in prior years, and a lot of more mental health commitments, especially in Anchorage, and those are a subset of that probate slice. There's also been an increase in the filing of those domestic violence protective orders. They've been up about 15% over the last 5 years and continue to rise.
Just our question on that, and then I'll get to the rule house. We increased the Superior Court judges. Did that have the impact that you were looking for, or did it just kind of fill up and level out?
That was the increase of two more judges in Anchorage that you're referring to 2 years ago, and those seats were recently permanently filled, because it does take some time for the appointments to be made through the constitutional process and the governor's appointment, and then the person starts. So those two seats are now filled permanently. Prior to that, we sometimes have pro tem judges filling in to help assist with the caseload. We need those, and there's been steady work for those positions for the past couple of years. Now that they are appointed and staffed with permanent sitting judges, we expect to see that the numbers in Anchorage will be much more handleable by the judges there.
Senator Wilkowski, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the probate increase, we've passed some legislation over the years to expand Alaska, well, I guess to make Alaska more competitive with other states in terms of estate planning. And one of the concerns I know that was voiced during that period of time was that it would increase the caseload. And just maybe when you put together your analysis, I'd be curious to hear if that's actually happening. We were told we didn't think it would, but we really didn't know. And so if there's legislation that we've passed that's had an impact, I'd be curious to know.
I'll have to look into that. I'm not prepared now with what that legislation did to that subset of the probate numbers, but I can find that out.
Senator Dyson also has a question.
I would be interested in knowing the number of felony cases for small amounts of controlled substances and whether or not that's been growing. I'm talking about felony convictions. And you can do that later.
I can do that, and I do know what you're talking about. I'll be able to get you that information.
Friends?
Okay. I think that's... I've hit the trends that I wanted to talk about, and I'd like to turn a little bit to a different area, if that's okay for the numbers. Okay. And if you have any questions about numbers, I can get statistics pretty well from our database. So, as you are aware, the legislature's work on amending statutes necessarily impacts other laws that are in effect on any given topic. The court system, unlike the executive branch, does not have any system of regulations to enforce statutes, but what we do have is court rules. Some of them are internal rules, kind of like your uniform rules for the legislature, that set tasks for or duties of different personnel or internal scheduling, things like that. But most of the rules of court are rules of practice and procedure. They govern how the cases move through the court, how specific types of cases are handled. They may establish deadlines for parties and the judges, and what the judge has to do before reaching a decision. And there are separate sets of procedural rules for different case types. I'm sorry. So there are the rules of civil procedure, rules of child in need of aid procedure, rules of probate procedure, etc. The Constitution gives the ultimate authority to make those procedural and practice rules to the Supreme Court, and the court uses a committee process to do that. It has standing civil rules committees, standing probate rules committees, standing criminal rules committees, etc. Draft rules are prepared by those committees, circulated to the public for comment, and then presented to the Supreme Court for its consideration on whether to adopt new rules or amend its existing rules. The legislature is also permitted by the Constitution to amend the court's procedural rules by a two-thirds majority vote, and you do that from time to time. Each year there are a number of bills that directly amend some of the court's rules. Many of the bills that you pass indirectly affect court rules. That is, it has some impact incidental on the procedure that the court uses, but you are not changing actual wording. When we get those, the court rules attorney takes those bills, brings them to the standing rules committees, and they decide whether some clarification would be advisable, even if the legislature didn't vote by two-thirds to change the court rule.
Just for what it's worth, Ms. Mead, from the Senate side, for the Senate colleagues on the Judiciary Committee, I have the newest set of court rules that we will get to each one of the committee members. So that's something that I, as a chair, decided I thought we should have available to us as we move forward. So.
And the book is that bright blue one up there. That every lawyer has on their desk. So even if the bills don't affect court rules, we are impacted, of course, by many of the bills that you consider each session. They might be bills dealing with criminal law and sentencing, or foster children, or crime victims, or conservatorships. There was a big one last year. Many other substantive areas of the law that the judges are called upon every day to interpret and apply. Bills can increase the number of cases that come to court. They might add new duties or procedures for the judge to use, or increase the likelihood that a certain case type will go to trial rather than be pled out. So there are lots of ways that we can be impacted, and that's why I attend so many of these committee meetings. But my role here is quite different from the role of the legislative liaisons from the executive branch agencies. The primary difference is that although the bills may affect us, unlike the executive branch, the Supreme Court generally takes no position on the merits of a bill. We only support or oppose legislation that directly impacts the structure of the judicial branch, and that's fairly rare. For most legislation, I can let you know what it costs, if there are technical problems, or if there's a way to achieve the bill's objective that might be more efficient or cheaper, but I will rarely say that the court system supports this bill or opposes that bill. And the reason that the court has chosen not to weigh in on the policy decisions that you make is sometimes not well known. But one key reason is that the court recognizes that it is the legislature's role, not the court's, to set public policy in the state. All three branches do set policy to a small degree, but it's the legislature that is charged with considering the will of the people and adopting and revising the statutes to reflect that will. The court leaves those decisions to you. Second, we don't take positions on bills because the court may very well be called upon to interpret those bills or respond to constitutional challenges to bills in the future, and the court's objectivity would very certainly be challenged or put into question if it was called upon to decide the constitutionality of a bill that it had officially supported or opposed when its merits were being debated here in this body. The third reason we don't take an official position on bills is that judges often disagree amongst themselves on the wisdom of various bills, just as you do. What is good policy is not always the same in everybody's mind. So there's frequently no judicial position or Alaska court system recommended stance on the policy expressed in a bill, and it would be inappropriate and possibly even misleading for me to testify otherwise. So for those reasons, I offer comments and suggestions, and I will point out any implementation problems and submit fiscal notes and help the committee in any other way that I can, but will very rarely support or oppose a bill. So having explained how the court system is set up and how we work and how we're different from the other agencies, I'd like to also focus on how we work well and interact with the other, with the executive branch agencies and other criminal justice entities. The justice agencies in Alaska have a really healthy and helpful relationships with each other to the benefit of the entire system. And many of our interactions are informal, the kind of working relationships you develop with anybody that you work with on a day-to-day basis. For example, our administrative office has to transmit criminal judgments to the Attorney General's office, which is in charge of collecting fines and restitution, for example. And so we have to speak to them constantly about data transmittal and where cases are and whether they have the documents. Those are just normal relationships that happen all the time. But those transmittals do take coordination and work. The standing rules committees that are appointed by the Supreme Court nearly all have representatives from the executive branch. The public defender sits on the criminal rules committee, as does the district attorney, and representatives from all different agencies are present at those committee meetings to ensure that the rules are going to be workable for everybody. The court system also works with agencies on a more formalized or structured basis. Many of you have heard of the Criminal Justice Working Group. That is a high-level group co-chaired by Justice Carpinetti and Attorney General Garrity, and it is comprised of high-level representatives, including commissioners of all the criminal justice entities. That group meets quarterly to discuss system-wide efficiencies and potential improvements in the operations of the criminal justice system, and they are working on implementing ideas that they've had and discussed over the last years. Another interagency group is called MAGIC, which is an acronym for Multi-Agency Justice Integration Consortium, so you can see why we just call it MAGIC. That committee has the court system and representatives from public safety and law and the Division of Motor Vehicles, and their job is to tackle the technology-related issues that that arise when we're transmitting data and information between and among these entities. For example, ensuring that our criminal judgments are quickly transmitted to Department of Public Safety for entry into their statewide criminal database, and that persons identifying information is in a format that's usable and readable by DPS's database. It's a bigger problem than anyone knows until you sit in on one of their committee meetings. So the reason I mention these collaborative efforts is just to emphasize that the criminal justice system and the justice system is indeed a system. It includes the courts, Department of Law, both AGs and DA, the Public Defender and Office of Public Advocacy, who will speak after me, both part of the Department of Administration, Division of Motor Vehicles. They have to know when the court has taken away somebody's driver's license under the statutes that you've passed, Office of Children's Services. We all work together, and I'm confident that any one of those agencies would also say that the system is integrated and interdependent. Decisions made that are targeted at one of those agencies will have repercussions that flow to all the other agencies within the system, including the court system. So if you appropriate more money for troopers for the Department of Public Safety, that means that there will likely be more arrests. That means that the prosecutors will likely be thinking about additional charges. That means more cases will likely be filed with the courts. That means the Department of Corrections will likely have more prisoners, and that is probably the goal of giving more troopers to the Department of Public Safety. But I think it's important to bear in mind that those changes affect the entire system and everybody in that system.
We have a question from Senator Dyson. You don't get to pick who comes in your doors.
Oh, I don't. That's correct.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, some years ago we worked on the concept of restorative justice, and part of that was to make it a high priority for restoring the victim to a pre-offense condition. And as I remember, we put in there the priority of any money that's there, that the victim gets paid before court costs and fines and everything else. Are you guys going by that?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, yes, restitution has the highest priority when money is able to be collected from somebody who's been convicted. Yes.
Thank you. Nancy, just so that those guys who actually feed your court system can get a chance to talk. We need to see if we can wrap it up. Give them, actually, we're doing pretty good. I just wanted to make sure they didn't get left out.
I will wrap up by touching on what Senator Coghill just mentioned, and that is we don't get to choose who comes in our doors. When cases are filed, we accept the filings. And if there is a change either in statute or policy at the prosecutor's office, that could change the number of filings that come to us, and we take those filings. And that's true of some of the other entities within the system. If the public defender is appointed to represent a defendant, they don't get to say, we're too busy. If a prisoner is sentenced, the Department of Corrections doesn't get to say, we're full. So that's just, again, something that we're a reactive institution, and it's good to bear that in mind sometimes. So I hope I've been able to provide some useful information. That is our overview. Any more questions, I'd be happy to handle.
Has a question.
Through the chair, what do you do with multiple pro per filings that border or cross the line to crazy?
Through the chair, you're referring to people who represent themselves, and of course anybody is entitled to file a case against anybody else. And dealing with self-represented parties is a difficult challenge for the court system. For some, in family law cases, we have a self-help center that helps them hone their pleadings and directs them to proper forms, for example, because the court wants it to be done as efficiently as possible. In terms of maybe vexatious litigants, there are some that we see coming in over and over with lawsuits that some might think are lacking in merit, but they do have that right. And the judges do give some deference to people who are not represented by an attorney. But it is a challenge. We don't stop them from filing those cases, but it can be difficult sometimes.
Sure. I mean, all branches of government get that same issue. But you don't want to stop an individual citizen's right to appeal to their government, whether it's in a court system or in the legislature or even to the administration through administrative hearings. So,
exactly.
So, yeah, I agree. Sometimes I know we get people who can be very vexing.
Vexing.
but they deserve the hearing, you know. So, I sure thank you. There are several things that are lingering in my mind. For example, I know you have an internal court improvement project issue that you work on. Somewhere along the line, probably on the Senate side, I'll be asking along that line when it's your turn to get back in front of us again. So, and some of the work that you do with the administration, specifically on some of the criminal justice working group issues, it'll be interesting to me to hear some of the discussion on a handful of issues. So, I don't know if you're the one. I might go to the Department of Law and ask them to help me, bring those to light. So, I sure appreciate your time. Is there any other questions before I ask Ms. Mead to step down? I sure appreciate the thoroughness in which you did this. It gives us a good look at the court system. There are different management styles, I know, between the different districts, the four different judicial districts, and necessarily so because of the different populations they serve, the different intensity. So those are questions that still linger in my mind on how our rules hit them. And so that's something that I hope that you'll kind of ponder as we go.
I will. Thank you. I look forward to it.
All right. So one of our members had to go as an entertaining with the Penwar folks, so I just got a note to make sure that they're aware of that. So thank you very much, Ms. Mead. Thank you very much. We have the Office of Public Defender come before us. Who is going to step forward?
Well, I think Senator Coghill, the slideshow is Office of Public Advocacy first, and then
Is it really?
Mm-hmm. I think it's
all right. Well, I guess we'll just take it. Introduce yourself and start your presentation.
Got a PowerPoint here.
All right. So that those listening know who's jumping line, introduce yourself.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. My name is Rick Allen, and it is my pleasure to serve as the public advocate for the state of Alaska.
It's not surprising that the advocate for the public would be jumping line. So, no, I appreciate the fact that you had those in order.
Mr. Steiner and I, our offices are right next to each other. We work very closely together, as Nancy said. It just died while it was sitting there, going dormant.
Well, you are good at winging it, so until we get
this is what you want to use to have, sir.
So we have a computer. You want me to take a brief ease while we set that thing going? All right, let's just take it off record for a moment while we get the computer going. Go ahead and bring this back. If the computer can turn on, that's fine. If not, I understand we do have in front of us the PowerPoint in paper. So for those of you who have that, I will share. That way we don't have to wait for a computer to come back to life.
You see it first.
Don't mind? All right.
That's same as this?
Okay, yeah, sure.
John, that's same as this.
Okay, actually, representing group. Oh, he's got one. Okay, good.
Mr. Allen, you are up.
Okay, thank you, sir. And as I said, thank you for having us today. So, turning to the first page of the PowerPoint, the mission statement of the Office of Public Advocacy. The Office of Public Advocacy provides legal advocacy and guardianship services to vulnerable Alaskans. I of course, don't intend to read this verbatim, but I just want to sort of discuss each slide as we go. Certainly, if anything comes up as I'm speaking, you've got questions about any of this, I'm happy to take those questions as we go. The Office of Public Advocacy has offices in five locations: Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, Palmer, and Bethel. And we're actually comprised of 14 separate and distinct law offices. And I'll get to the structure of OPLA in a minute, because it's a pretty unique structure. And so I want to spend a little bit of time describing that. But then just looking at the general functions of OPLA. Provides guardianship and conservatorship services to incapacitated individuals, guardian ad litem services, that's for abused and neglected children. We have an elder fraud unit that represents elders who have been defrauded in a way that sort of falls through the cracks of criminal law. We allow them to be able to pursue civil remedies. We provide attorney services for parents in child in need of aid cases. Conflict cases, we do criminal cases from the conflicts from the Public Defender Agency. We represent respondents in guardianship proceedings, and we provide court visitors in guardianship and conservative proceedings for the court system. OPLA has 47 attorneys and 78 staff, including the public guardians. And as I indicated, that's with 14 individual units in five locations around the state of Alaska. We are, of course, a statewide agency. We represent people throughout the state of Alaska, and so we utilize private contract attorneys and private contract guardian ad litems in the locations where we do not have offices. Turning to the budget, FY 2012 public guardian receipts, the 607 that is authorized for use, that hasn't changed. That's been, I think, our number for a couple of years now. You may see us at some point make a request to up that number a bit. FY 2013 management plan 24862.9. I'm now on slide 6. Great, thank you very much. So, some of our accomplishments since I was here last year, we've really worked hard to level out the contractor costs. As I mentioned, we do utilize private contractors quite a bit. And when I became the public advocate, that was the variable that was very difficult to to sort of get our hands on, and it made it very difficult to have any kind of budgetary certainty. As with the court system and the public defender agency, we are a downstream agency, and we have no ability to say, you know, no, sorry, we don't want any more clients. We take everybody who's sent to us. So some of the things that we've done in order to try to get some more budgetary certainty, we are keeping more cases in-house, and one of the major ways we did that was to create a new unit without additional positions. We pulled PCNs from other units and created the Anchorage Conflict Office, and I will talk a little more about that and the impact that change has had in the last year. We've also gotten fairly aggressive in terms of challenging improper appointments by the court. OPA, we do so many different things that we had kind of been known as a sort of a catch-all. And when the court wanted, you know, they felt like, oh, this person ought to have a lawyer or ought to have some representation, very often they would just turn to OPA and say, oh, you know, OPA, you're appointed to handle this. Well, in some of those cases, that didn't fit within our enabling statute. They were not proper appointments. And so we've actually worked with the court system collaboratively, and Doug Wolliver, I know most of you probably know Doug, developed a fantastic manual for the judges. It really lays out, you know, when OPA should be appointed and when the court should look to what's called 12E counsel, where the court does the appointment. You know, we've worked hard to try to educate.
I think Representative Ledoux has a question.
Yeah, I noticed that most of your services seem to involve situations where you're representing the public, when they're having difficulties with state agencies and so forth. So where does the elder fraud come in? Why isn't that just handled elder fraud? Why isn't that just handled through the charging somebody with fraud?
Sure. Through the chair, that's a great question. The reason that the elder fraud unit was created, and it really hasn't been that long ago, I think maybe about 5 years ago, is because there's a whole level of fraud against elders that is really quasi-criminal. And I can tell you, I spent almost 8 years as a prosecutor in Alaska. I can tell you that, you know, that's a real problem. There's a lot of improper conduct, and sadly, very often these are the adult children of these folks that are ripping their parents off. But sometimes they'll have a power of attorney or other document giving them some colorable right to do what they're doing. And that can sometimes take them out of the pure criminal realm. So it doesn't neatly fit into our current fraud statutes. And so the Department of Law is very reluctant to wade into these sort of family issues and these kind of problems. But yet we had this just real problem with these, you know, elders in Alaska getting ripped off and frankly finding, you know, we were having people empty their parents' bank accounts, travel around the world, and leave their parents destitute back in Alaska. I mean, the examples that I could show you would absolutely shock you. So I think that the legislature was wise to step in some years ago and say, you know, there's got to be some remedy for this, folks. There's got to be some help. And we typically only assist indigent elders who have been defrauded. So, you know, if somebody has means and they've been defrauded, but they're still left with means, then, you know, typically it would be on them to hire their own private attorney to pursue those remedies. But so often we see these folks that have been just financially decimated, and they're left with nothing. And so then we will help them recover. Now, interestingly, I didn't have this in the slideshow, but one thing about elder fraud that's a little different, If we're successful for an elder, and if it's, for example, if it's a considerable amount of money, I mean, sometimes it could be, you know, $1 million, and we're able to recover the money for the elder, then we will charge them fees for our service, and they will reimburse the state for the work that we did. You know, that is kind of the unusual case, because usually you're talking about people that are already on the margin, and then they've been just driven into poverty, and so we're, you know, trying to help them, you know, get their house back or be able to, you know, feed themselves, that kind of stuff. So, but we do see sort of the spectrum in terms of the type of fraud that's committed.
One other follow up on that, but I got to keep it brief. Senator Dyson has a question, and you're going to take all of Mr. Steiner's time. So let's get to the point.
So do most of these people that you're suing have any money to recover anything?
Yeah, through the chair. Usually, it's a situation where they have essentially stolen somebody's home or you know, some other major asset. Yes, and we can try to get that back.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah. Very interesting. Medicaid, Medicare fraud, and Health and Human Services has a significant part of their staff. They're working on, I think they call it integrity, some section. And I know the Attorney General's office is an increasingly effective looking at fraud. Most of what they're looking at is provider fraud. And I know one huge area that I believe is being abused is personal care attendants. Mm-hmm. And that is certainly the senior who is involved in that. They suffer physically, emotionally, not necessarily financially, but providers are making a lot of money. Some people have estimated between $200,000 and $500,000, you know, the public money in our state. How in the world, how does your organization relate to that provider fraud? And you can answer offline.
Sure. I'll make it very brief, and I'm happy to have a more in-depth discussion with you. Through the chair, the Department of Law has a grant from the federal government to, and they've assigned a particular prosecutor man by the name of Andrew Peterson, who that's what he focuses on, and that's what he does. And so we do interact with them, and we have a great working relationship with them. You know, it's kind of an interesting situation. I mean, our elder fraud unit is really a quasi-prosecution unit. That's kind of the way to look at it. And so we work very closely with them, and you know, we also work very closely with Adult Protective Services. And so the agencies figure out what's appropriate given the facts of a certain situation.
I'd like to have a further conversation offline.
Yes, sir. Happy to do that.
At your convenience.
Yes, sir.
Just I'm going to give you probably about 7 or 8 more minutes. The question that I'll be looking for somewhere along the line is the larger portion of the court's time is on probate, and just what your portion of that ends up to be if it's in the indigent area.
Yes, sir. I'll be happy to address that. Senator, I want to show you this graph here on contractor costs, because it's something frankly that I'm quite proud of. We, as I said, when I became the public advocate, the contractor cost was the variable that we just simply couldn't get our hands on. And you know, a murder case that you send out to a private contractor was running us upwards of $120,000-$150,000 just in attorney's fees. And I saw that as, you know, just an unsustainable practice. We were literally sending millions of dollars out the door, and, you know, with no real way to predict how this was going to go, because, of course, we can't predict how crime is going to happen, when the next big, you know, 6 co-defendant murder case is going to happen, that kind of thing. So we've taken several steps to try to, especially in the criminal realm, bring as much in-house as we possibly can, and that way, you know, having more budgetary certainty, because of course we're talking about salaried lawyers. And So I mentioned the Anchorage Conflict Council, the ACC unit that we now have in Anchorage. We made that unit up. It's four lawyers and one paralegal. Pulled PCNs from other units within OPA, so no new PCNs. In the past 11 months, so it's only been around 11 months. Past 11 months, they've handled over 600 cases. Of that, over 300 of those cases have been felonies, many of them very, very high-level felonies that would have cost, that all of those cases, all 600 of those cases, would have gone out the door last year. Before this ACC was created, they would have all gone to private contractors. And so that unit alone has saved the state hundreds of thousands of dollars. And we had a goal here, and it was a very ambitious goal, which was to drop attorney contractor cost growth to 2% annually, to tilt down the growth curve down to 2%. And I'm very happy to report that right now we're on pace to actually beat that goal and be 1% less than last year. So not only reducing growth, but actually reducing the size, which, you know, that could change if we got hit with, as I said, several big multi-codefendant murders or something like that. But we see this, you can see the red line here on the chart, we see this as a very, very positive development. And, you know, we're able to provide high-quality representation for these folks in a way that doesn't break the bank for the state of Alaska.
Good to hear.
So a couple challenges, and Senator, this goes to your question. The public guardian caseloads, they continue to explode on us. This state is aging rapidly, as I think everyone in this room understands, and that's just not going to change. We're going to see more and more folks becoming wards of the state, and in that we're going to see more and more folks in probate and all of these related legal issues that OPA is going to need to step in and provide representation for these folks. Our public guardians do a fantastic job. They have massive caseloads. Those caseloads continue to rise, but we've got to address this at some point, and I have an idea for that that I'd like to discuss here in a minute. Bethel caseloads also continue to rise. They continue to be significant, we're doing the best we can to stay on top of that. And then the third challenge is, in December 2011, there was a Supreme Court ruling, ANDVSA versus OPA, that expanded a ruling in a case called Flores. I don't want to go into all the details, but it is expanded who we represent in certain types of civil cases when it comes to child custody matters. We're not in the divorce business, but we are in the business of representing folks in child custody matters if the other side is represented by a public agency. So those cases come. This chart really illustrates for you what I was discussing regarding public guardians. It's just going up, 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 and we're going to have to address that need. Some of the efficiencies, criminal justice working group, working on electronic discovery, that's coming along. As I discussed about Bethel and some other regions, we need to place the resources where we've got the booming caseloads. And then the final one I wanted to point out here, implementation of SEM data system for public guardian trust activities, very important. Our public guardians handle all of the trust, all of the money for all of the wards of the state of Alaska. We're talking well over 1,000 people. It's a very complex system. And when I arrived at OPA, the data system was still a DOS system from, I think, 1982 that was managing all of these people's money, and completely inefficient. Just a completely antiquated system. And so this year, we have totally revamped that and updated it to this SEM system. It's a proper Windows system, state of the art, and will definitely provide a better service to our folks. Cost containment, I did discuss the contractor costs. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the public guardian system. So on the children's side, with regard to children in need of aid. We have both guardian ad litem, but we also, OPA has the CASA program. CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and those are citizens in the community, people of goodwill, often retired school teachers, folks like that, who care about Alaskan children, who volunteer to get trained to serve as advocates for these kids, and they take on one kid at a time. They don't take on big caseloads, but they get to go into court and advocate for these kids just like a GAL. It's a fantastic program. It's a national program and really does a lot of good. What I'd like to do is take that model and move it in the public guardian realm and start having OPA training and encouraging folks to volunteer to be public guardians and giving them the resources that they need to do that. So instead of, you know, Uncle Joe becoming a ward of the state and having the state completely care for Uncle Joe's affairs, OPA is going to give you the tools you need so that you can help Uncle Joe and you can work with him and give him what he needs. That's going to provide better service to the wards, and it's going to be able to allow us to provide the services that we need in terms of public guardian services without breaking the bank. It's not a fix-all, but I think it's a tool that could be used to help us down the road. So with that, I will be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Yeah, Representative Foster has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to Bethel, is that boom due to fewer attorneys per capita, not just for Bethel, but for the whole region there? I know it's a high population area. Or is it because there are now more troopers in the area, or what's that due to?
Through the chair, you know, I think it's a variety of factors. I would say that a big part of it, though, is just simply demographics. When you look at it and you look at Western Alaska, there's a large growing young population. Folks there are having more kids, and there's just simply more people in the communities. And so, anytime you increase population, crime and other social issues are going to go along with that. But I do think there's a factor in terms of increasing police presence, that kind of thing. That's got to play a role. And then the other thing that we know, and this is statewide, but I think disproportionately so in Western Alaska, is that, when we changed the laws with regard to sex cases, those cases don't have the room for negotiation that they once did. And so we're seeing a huge uptick in trials. And that's happening in Western Alaska, but it's also happening in Anchorage and Fairbanks and other parts of the state. But so I would say there's just a number of factors that have led to, a real squeeze there in terms of services. And I would suspect that the DAs would say the same, and I would suspect that Mr. Steiner would say the same about his shop, that the numbers are just really going up out there, and it kind of puts a strain on everybody.
Thank you. I made you rush through it. Sorry. Time being what it is down here, but you did good.
I completely understand. Thank you.
You were talking fast. Now we get to see how good a fast-talking public defender might be able to do. So if we can get Quinlan up here.
Through the chair?
Yes.
He could have a second career as an auctioneer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Steiner, and please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska and the director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. I'm going to give you a similar brief overview of the agency, but I welcome any questions along the way. The Public Defender Agency's constitutional mandate is to provide legal representation to indigent clients in certain types of cases. We only take cases when we are appointed by the court. The agency was created in 1969 to serve this function, where before it was the function of private lawyers to accept these cases for a nominal fee. Primarily, the agency's business is to review charges, review cases, communicate those rights to clients, and then ultimately represent those clients in court. The vast majority of what our attorneys do is reviewing the state's case and reviewing the investigation that's been done and talking to the clients about those cases. Ultimately, decisions about whether or not to plead or whether or not to go to trial are the clients. So we serve very much in the role as advisory, in an advisory capacity so that they can make decisions. And we do this before all the courts of Alaska, the District Court, the Superior Court, and the Appellate Courts. We receive our cases only after court appointment. The court reviews them for indigency findings, and we accept those appointments. We do have a requirement that we attempt to get out of cases when they're not clearly authorized, if it's not the appropriate subject matter or if the person is not clearly indigent, we will move to withdraw. And it does not happen a great deal. Those things are difficult to know. We don't investigate our clients. That's the court system's responsibility. But when we do find out information that somebody has money or is not clearly authorized, we will move to withdraw.
Representative Ledoux.
Through the chair, if there is a multiple defendant case in which you know there may be a conflict of interest, as there usually is, can the defendants waive, if they're in the public defender system, can they waive that conflict? Because I actually can see situations where everybody might be in better shape keeping their mouth shut than having three separate attorneys. I'm just wondering whether they have the ability to waive that conflict, as do people who are represented by private attorneys.
Yes, it's theoretically possible that two people in a conflict situation could waive that conflict. But with regard to criminal cases, felonies in particular, no attorney would advise their client to waive that conflict. So as a matter of policy, when we have co-defendants, we will keep one co-defendant, and then we'll move to withdraw from the other. There are one type of case where we don't do that. It's a minor in possession. Often the police will arrest a number of minors at a party, and there really is no actual conflict most of the time. So we can represent multiple people charged in the same case. It's possible that there could be an adverse situation in terms of the presentation of the defense, but typically that really doesn't come up. But otherwise, we, as a policy, will just move to withdraw. Yes, and all those cases go to the Office of Public Advocacy, of course. We are the primary provider, and we conflict out, you'll see in one of the later slides, in a relatively low percentage of our cases, about 12.5% result in a conflict of interest. The agency is composed of four divisions, a criminal division, a civil division, an appellate division, and an administrative division. And we maintain 13 offices across the state. All but a few of our offices are sort of general practice. Our criminal attorneys will handle child in need of aid cases and juvenile delinquency cases, as well as civil commitment matters, Anchorage and Fairbanks and Bethel. And our larger offices will specialize in practice, just criminal. The civil division handles the child in need of aid and the juvenile delinquency, as well as the civil commitments. We've grouped them that way just based upon the similarity of issues that get litigated. Issues involving juveniles tend to be similar to the issues that are raised in child in need of aid cases, though juvenile delinquency is a quasi-criminal situation. Just the pace of the case and the nature of what's at stake tends to mesh well with the child in need of aid cases. Here's a map just showing our locations. We really are all over the state. And that is one of our challenges, communications and travel and with respect to witnesses, but also our own attempt to investigate and be everywhere in the state. Not an atypical challenge for any state agency. We presently employ 173 attorneys, investigators, paralegals, and support staff. Our FY13 management plan budget is $25.5 million, and this included an increment to respond to the caseload increases of $950,000.
Representative Millett, you have a question?
I do. What's your average caseload for each attorney? Has it gone down, or is it continuing to go up?
It continues to go up. We last received, with the exception of the judge's bill last year, we haven't received new positions since 2009. So it's, as the caseload goes up, our average caseload goes up per attorney. There's the absolute case number, which I don't think is representative. It's right around 250 cases per attorney on average. We try to do a weighted average to put it in line with ABA standards for ethical representation. We have creeped up to about 147 cases per attorney. That is based upon an analysis by the ADA and a recommendation that no attorney carry more than 150 cases per year under that weighted average. We start to feel the pressure of that, and you can kind of tell there is some validity just anecdotally from that number. You see attorneys start to redline when they start to receive more cases. And we try to keep that by weighted average. We're also able to sort of balance and distribute resources around the state to sort of, as best we can, keep that under that number.
What's your average time for a public defender to stay within your agency? What's the burnout rate, I guess, is what I'm thinking.
You know, I haven't calculated the turnover rate recently, but as a result of the changes that we made in terms of our recruitment and training and mentoring program, we've seen attorneys stay longer, and we've been able to really get the benefits, and the clients have received the benefits of fully trained attorneys who are trained by us in how we conduct and review and handle cases. So right now what I see is the strongest trial units that I've seen since I've been there, and I'm impressed continually by the work that they're able to do, and we do have to overload them on occasion, and they've shouldered it well.
5 years, 10 years?
I'd say about 5 to 7 years. Once you start pushing past, some will burn out right away. They'll just realize it's not for them, and you'll see them leave within 3 years. Then the people who are looking for trial experience and want to move on, about 5 to 7, because that experience they can take out into private practice and make a lot more money. But once you push past 7 years, you tend to see people stay for careers.
Is that, for me, is that higher than in your general practicing area because of, I know in the cities you get to have a division of effort on specialty. The further out you get, does that change the burnout rate?
You know, it hasn't seemed to. I think we've seen a lot of stability in our smaller offices. We have intentionally hired people who we thought would want to live in those communities. And we don't ask people to serve a term of a couple years before they can come back to Anchorage. We look for candidates who want to live in rural communities. And so people have stayed there. You know, people are often unsure that they want to go to a rural community. I've hired people from, for example, New York City to go to Kotzebue. And we tell them there's no commitment in terms of time. You can apply for another job. We say, you know, move to the community, see what you think about it. And a lot of people just stay much longer than they ever plan to, because once they get involved in the communities, the tendency is that they really enjoy living in rural Alaska. So we actually do better in many
ways. Gabrielle, you have a question, Representative?
Yeah. How did the salaries of PDs compare to the salaries of prosecutors?
We're on the same system. We're exactly the same system. We hire at the same step and same level, and we promote according to the policy of the state with regard to the attorney classifications.
Has that always been that way, that the PDs and the prosecutors are paid basically the same general wages?
You know, I'd read reports that issue had been raised and looked into. In my tenure, it was looked into, and there was no disparity found. And I think that allows us not to compete with each other, except on, I think, the things that matter, training and supervision and the type of work that people are interested in.
Senator Wilkowski, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you hiring a high percentage of people from outside of Alaska?
We hire a great number of people from outside of Alaska. We focus specifically on law clerks who are clerking for the Alaska courts and people who've interned for us. We don't have a law school here, and Alaskans aren't enough of the candidate pool to hire. So we hire a lot of people from out of state. But most of them have a connection here one way or the other. That's who we focus on, people who have an interest in living here and have an interest in the practice.
And I don't want to thwart questions, but we got about 4 minutes to limit. Senator Dyson?
Percentage of cases, felony cases that get pled up? Or Class A misdemeanors?
I would say, and I didn't look up this statistic specifically, but trial cases probably account for 3%. Maybe more percent of the cases, the rest result in either a dismissal or a plea agreement. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was 90%. I didn't look up the percentage that resulted in dismissal.
Different than that, let me know.
I certainly will.
Thank you, sir.
That is something.
Thank you, Senator Dyson.
I have a slide here that communicates sort of the history of the funding. This is the growth in the agency's budget. It's separated in between authorized budget and the caseload increment that is contained in the authorized budget and the supplemental budget. As far as I know, the supplemental budget has been a part of this agency going back to 1969. I didn't check every year, but I did see that in 1969 they were given half of their request and came back for a supplemental. This year we're on target to actually have no supplemental for the first time in my memory. And that has been accomplished through two main strategies. We've increased the vacancy rate a bit, and there's been some supplemental assistance from the Department of Administration. For FY14, that has yet to be determined, so there hasn't been a budget request put forward at this time. I expect any request to be part of the amended request. Here is a chart showing the caseload growth since 2009, and I picked 2009 as the starting point for this. That was the last time that we received positions for caseload growth, with the exception of the judges' bill, one position to match the increase in Superior Court judges. Total caseload has increased 16%. Misdemeanors have increased 7%. Felonies increased 10%. Our largest jump has been in the other caseload, which is primarily petitions to revoke probation. There's been a huge increase in that caseload. Though not a particularly complex caseload, it has resulted in a significant increase in clients. And in client contact and the time we spend talking to clients about the resolution of their cases, a time-consuming process. You know, we're down at the jail, we're spending time talking to them and communicating the case and the implications and making a decision really is probably the bulk of what we actually do. Here's one of the projects we had worked on for the last 3 years, and I think I've mentioned it many times, is our attempt to reduce the number of conflicts. We had a system in place where all of our closed files were essentially not closed and open, and because of the rules of ethical conduct, all the knowledge in those files and all the notes in those files is imputed knowledge. It created conflicts across the state unnecessarily. So what we do now is we archive files off-site with a third party, so they're not open to all of our attorneys. And that has reduced the number of conflicts. The reason that is important, obviously, is fewer cases that go to OPA, the fewer cases that end up in the hands of higher cost contractors. The cost of us processing and handling cases is much lower than contractors and ultimately slightly lower than OPA due to the large size of our agency. We're a single law firm. We act as a single law firm across the state, so it's easier for us to absorb increases in the year that they occur. As a result, we provide support from one office. For example, Bethel supports Dillingham, Fairbanks supports Barrow, Nome and Kotzebue work together as one region, and Juneau supports all of Southeast. In that way, if there's a case that needs to be moved just because of caseload gets too high, it's more easily done. Here is the performance measures that kind of loosely track what happens as a result of caseloads and vacancy rates. As you can see, we made good progress in terms of client contact. And we keep a performance measure about how quickly we contact people, because this is a measure of how responsive we are to the state's case. good client contact results in earlier disposal of the case. It also results in better practice. The reason it results in earlier disposal is clients expect an early response from us to advise them about the case, and the sooner that happens, the sooner the case can get resolved. It, in my opinion, results in outcomes that are more appropriate. And so that's why we track this in particular. We were making improvements up until 2011. 2012, we have seen some decrease as a result of the increase in our vacancy rate.
And just for what it's worth, as a committee, I'd like to have him finish his slides, so if you have to go, but I think I'll stay in he gets to do that. And I have a 3:15, so I want to get done by 3:10 if I can, but if you can finish sooner, so much the better.
I'll try to move it along. That is something we are going to be paying close attention to and hope to bring back up for this year. Also, you know, the appellate division and our response to appeals, you'll see, is quite low. The reason that response is quite low is there's an enormous backlog of appellate matters. Presently, when a notice of appeal is filed and the transcript is prepared and is ready to be prepared, it's a 12-month wait before somebody even gets assigned an attorney. And so our response within 90 days is not, that's why it's so low. What you're seeing there is our response to the expedited cases. Child need of aid matters go first because they involve children, and their cases need finality much sooner than other typical cases. There has been a huge increase in the trial rate in the last year, and part of our response has gone down as a result of that. Cases are just taking longer as a result of the increase in appeals, and I'm not sure how long that trend will continue, but it is so far in 2012 and continuing in 2013. At this time, I don't know that that'll abate, so that'll be an issue you may hear about. I won't spend too much time on this. Rick covered these a bit in his presentation. Electronic discovery is something that we've been working on a long time. The sooner we're able to process a case, the better for all parties. It's something we strive for. And one of the components of this is early discovery. This program is designed to assist us in getting discovery quickly and without failure. Right now, it's passing a lot of paper around, which results in a lot of lost time, essentially. We use our case management system and performance measures to make sure that we're appropriately responding to cases around the state. We'll redeploy resources when we see that one office is carrying too heavy of a burden compared to others, and we'll make those decisions along the way. We've done that in the last year, moving positions where we think that the need is greatest. You know, our cost containment measures revolve primarily around how we litigate cases, making sure that our trial attorneys are as experienced and supported as they need to be to make decisions. Mistakes, decisions made at the wrong time, can result in enormous costs and increased conflicts. So, you know, we're reviewing their work, making sure they're trained to make the decisions that they're required to make, and following up on that. Part of that is expert witness and travel requests. We make sure that the expert witnesses are appropriate for the case and the expenditure is justified, and that the requests are made and litigated at the right time so that it doesn't cause delay. We're attempting to increase our electronic archiving of files to reduce costs and actually shipping files around the state. The further we get away from paper, the quicker things can happen at a much cheaper cost. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I sure appreciate you coming, Mr. Steiner. A lot of questions, but I'm gonna call this to a close. Thanks to Ms. Mead, thanks to Mr. Allen, giving us an overview. As you can see, each one of you probably could have taken one joint session. Probably there's so much that goes on. And for what it's worth, in your world, I know the things that come your way just come your way. And I think we as a legislator just need to understand that and then how you handle it. And the caseload is not unnoticed. You know, especially in the years where I think there's going to be more frugal budgeting, it's going to be interesting to see how we handle these things. So With that, I'll turn the gavel back over to the House representatives.
Just want to mention that Friday, the 25th, 1:30, Department of Public Safety overview. And again, thank you on behalf of the House. All three.
Thank you, guys.